All right, Elaine, shall we go ahead and get started?
Sure.
Great. Welcome, everyone. I hope you're all having a lovely spring afternoon. My name is Adam Smith. I'm the Associate Dean of the faculty, and I'm very pleased to welcome everybody here to this faculty forum. I'm very delighted today that we have with us Elaine Westbrooks, the Carl A. Kroc Librarian and Vice Provost. I've had the truly wonderful opportunity to hear Elaine speak on the challenges that are currently facing academic libraries today and their implications for everything that we do on campus, from research to teaching to tenure and promotion. So I'm really quite pleased that we were able to bring Elaine to this faculty forum today to share her sense of the landscape of academic publishing today. So with that introduction, Elaine, I know that people want to hear from you and are really eager to get your perspective on what's going on. So I'm going to pass it off to you.
Great. Thank you, Adam. It's just a wonderful opportunity to be able to discuss an important topic that is dear to my heart. This is something I've been thinking about for decades. And I would say that in my role as a librarian and as a leader, one of the biggest problems that we've been grappling with is the growing costs associated with buying and acquiring research that is published by our scholars across the world. And this has been such a problem for such a long time. And, you know, there's a faculty library board, and I hope some of the members of the faculty library board are on this call, but this is something that we talk about every meeting. And I think it's really important because it impacts the library, but it impacts all of you. It impacts the publishing industry. It impacts the funders and philanthropists. And this is just a higher ed problem. It's not a library problem. So today I thought I would be really provocative and put out some statements that I'd love for you to react, because I do not see myself as just talking at you for the next hour, but I really want a discussion because you are part of this whole ecosystem. And I would argue, like, my fundamental premise is that the academic publishing system where we communicate as scholars is broken. It is closed. It is unaffordable. It is opaque, and it is unsustainable. And you all might be aware of the fact that the library is currently socializing our intent to unbundle our Elsevier Science Direct package. And this is one of the things that I can do as a university librarian, to say we will not be able to license as many journals as we have in the past. But to me, that is not a strategy. That is just one thing that I'm doing to say, look, we spend $9.2 million every 3 years on Science Direct. We can't continue to spend that money, $3 million a year. That is not sustainable. And it, quite frankly, it's just not right. This is exorbitant costs. The rate of inflation that we pay is just, it is absolutely unacceptable. So I will put out some statements. I'll put out the disclaimer, and then I'd love to hear some of your thoughts about any of the things that I write. And some of these statements that I'm making, I'm not necessarily saying I believe in all of these things 100%, but I have opinions about all of these things, and I'd love to hear your ideas. And so I don't want you to hate me for some of these statements, but I intentionally created these statements so that you all can engage, right? So the first one, statement that I think is true or could be true, is that academic publishing is really in the hands of an oligopoly, that there are five companies that control the bulk of publishing, particularly when you talk about science. And those companies are Elsevier, Springer, Wiley, Taylor & Francis, and Sage. Now, the distance between Elsevier, Springer, and Wiley, those are the big three. Taylor & Francis and Sage are minor, small actors compared to Elsevier and Springer and Wiley, right? So I kind of put those, and that oligopoly, you got three companies that really dominate, and then there's the two small companies that really don't. The second provocative statement is that researchers like all of you actually can change the system. Now, it's not easy, and if it were easy, we would have changed it by now. It is incredibly complicated and complex, which is why this problem persists. But I do think that you as authors, as publishers, but also consumers of the research articles that are being published, you are in the driver's seat to actually make the changes that we need to make. Now, agreeing on the changes is also one of the biggest challenges that we have, but I believe that you're on the driver's seat. Number three, I would argue that peer review is not sustainable. There was an article that I just read that basically stated, and I think I have this quote here, that, and I think in 2020, they tried to compute how many hours are spent on peer review, and the number was 100 million, and that's an estimate of what reviewers worked on peer reviews globally. So it's 100 million hours. And we all know that in most cases, this is time-consuming, but you are not typically compensated for those awards for doing the peer review. And it is hard to get people to review articles these days. If you're an editor, I've been an editor of a journal, it is really hard. Just to get three people to review an article, you need to invite 12, right? So that's one of the reasons why I think peer review is unsustainable. Number four, this is something I might die on this sword. There's too much. There's too much growth. There are over 40,000 journals out there, and they just keep growing and growing and growing. Every year there are more and more and more. And I can't say that the quality is always getting better with this. And I'm talking about 40,000 legitimate journals. I'm not even talking about the fake journals and the paper mills and all that stuff that are really harming the system. But I would argue that it would be much more important to focus on quality and not quantity. And so, and thinking about how do you get promoted, how do you get tenure, how do you think who should be hired and who are the great scholars, that there's a lot of focus on numbers, but there could be more focus on the quality. Number five is this term, the addiction to journals, is not my term. This is a term that I attribute to Holton Thorpe, who is the editor of, I should know, this is even Nature or Science. But he came to a panel with all the university librarians across North America and basically said, there's an addiction to journals. And this is something that's been a problem for a really long time. And I would add that it threatens higher education, and it's not good for innovation, and it's not good for science scholarship and discovery. That kind of ties into my whole thesis of that this is a major problem that is that goes beyond libraries. Number six, I think open access is something that people often get confused about. But at the end of the day, if you want to be read the most and you want to have more people access what you write in your research, open access is the best choice. Now, I realize the way open access is done nowadays, a lot of it is about you have to pay. You have to pay a fee in order to make that article open. And I think that creates a lot of barriers. But I also know that there are open access journals that are peer-reviewed and legit that do not charge their authors in order to publish in them. Number seven, the taxpayers pay for NSF and NIH. They also allow universities to have nonprofit status. If they're funding it, maybe they should have access to it. The fact that most of the journals that are licensed are behind a paywall, and the only way you can access it is if you work at a place like Cornell, to me seems to be prohibitive. Number eight, this I think might probably attract some of the most concern from this audience, but I think it's really a challenge that the societies, the learned societies, the associations that we all belong to, often depend on the library to fund their operations. And so what I mean by that is you publish a journal, it's a high quality journal, yet you are incentivized to make more revenue off the journal to fund a conference, to fund scholarships, to fund student awards, to fund professional development. I know that in certain fields, particularly since the pandemic, people are not becoming members of societies and associations to the same degree. And so as those numbers drop, the pressure on the publishing arm of society gets higher. And what often happens is you sell your journal to Springer or Wiley or another publisher, and you get more money. However, the costs tend to go up, and then I can't afford to necessarily subscribe to that journal any longer. So societies, I think, are so important, but if you are focused solely on generating revenue, then I would argue that you are becoming a publisher and not necessarily a society. Number nine, preprint servers were not designed to reduce the addiction to journals. We all know that Archive was developed here, started at Los Alamos, Paul brought it to Cornell. It is an amazing technology that we have. I would just argue that as wonderful as it is, there are still physics journals. There are still biostatistics journals. There are still journals that are important for people to publish in order to get tenure, and that the preprint server has definitely sped up research and the dissemination of research and created a community, but it has not necessarily disrupted the scholarly communication ecosystem that I'm talking about today. And then the final provocative statement I have is that the impact factor is a poor metric for quality, and that if I had my druthers, I would banish impact factors, and I would say that we should be looking at quality in different kinds of ways than assigning a number to a journal, because just because a journal has a high impact factor doesn't mean that every article that was published in an issue is going to be quality. You can't just assume that it will be quality just because of the impact factor. So I'm going to pause there. And I believe, Adam, like, I can take questions throughout, correct? So
absolutely, yes.
Yeah. So I have actually a slide associated with a lot of these statements, but I did want to see if anybody wanted to venture a question or a debate or something about any of these provocative statements, or if you want me to focus on some of my thoughts on any 10 of these provocative statements. So I'll pause there to see if anyone, and Adam, if you'll, I can't see who is asking.
I'll call on folks. John, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I was president of SIAM, Society for Industrial and Applied Math, in 1997-98, and that was a period when people were moving to electronic publications of journals that had been print only. Sarah Thomas, when she was librarian at Cornell, was part of a vigorous effort in order to wrest control of scholarly publications from the large publishers. That effort was a miserable failure, I think largely because universities did not have the wherewithal to stand up to the publishers in the threat of lawsuits. And I can give a few examples of, I think, things that happened in that regard. I would like to see the universities really take full possession of scholarly publication and declare that the commercial publishers no longer qualify as being publishers of academic material. Universities can partner with societies. They can create a system in order to publish and distribute what they have in a cost-effective way. At that point, I estimated that one of the biggest costs to universities was deciding which journals to buy and which ones not to buy. And the advent of the large bundles and the consolidation of the publishers has upended that apple cart so that we are now hostage, as you've described, to the big publishers. I would like to see all of that really change, and it will only change if universities together find a way to take the commercial publishers out of this business.
Thank you, John. That you're like gung ho. Like, let's kind of just take control.
That's an extreme view.
Yeah.
I realize, but you know that the rise of junk journals and papers that are being written by AI chatbots, it's destroying the system. It's truly destroying the system. And so we need a new system. Let's recreate it.
Well, if I could respond to a few points you're making. Now, of course, I know Sarah Thomas, and she was the university librarian when I was hired many, many years ago. And I have to give her credit. She did get Project Euclid off the ground, which was dedicated to math, primarily to math journals. And Project Euclid is now part of Duke University Press. So it wasn't a complete disaster, but she was pivotal in making sure that Project Euclid got off the ground and still exists today.
And I was the primary advocate for that.
Yeah, well, great. Thank you. But, John, I really do appreciate your comments, and I think that this might be a time. I'll go back to the provocative statements, but I do want to be, I guess, fair and say that I'm not saying that all of these for-profit publishers are bad actors. I believe that they do add value, and they are able to do things efficiently and professionally in ways that save time and energy of the researcher to a certain degree. I also want to make clear that university presses are nonprofit institutions, and I don't think they're really part of the problem. Now, of course, you have Oxford and Cambridge, which are kind of in the class to themselves, but by and large, university presses have stepped up to do some really interesting things in publishing journals, publishing monographs, and I think that's been amazing. The fourth part is that the fact that the library can no longer afford to license all the journal subscriptions that we used to is just really a symptom of the bigger problem that we have. And then finally, I would say that we need so many different people from different disciplines, because the disciplinary differences are significant. You cannot say what's happening in the humanities is the same thing as happening in chemistry. And so I think we need a lot of different ideas and perspectives to come to bear to this wicked problem, because it plays out differently in the disciplines, and it plays out differently across institutions and societies and things like that. So I just wanted to make it clear, I am not a hater of all multinational for-profit publishers. I think there are challenges there, but I think we have to find a new kind of way to engage them. And I do think there was a point where scholars did have control over this whole system. And peer review was something that was manageable. We also didn't have AI slop that is really, you know, clogging up the system and writing articles and doing peer review and things like that. It was a different time, but there was a moment where scholars were in control, and I would argue that those days are gone. And when journals became electronic, the publishing industry was able take advantage of that and create these huge bundles of journals that we used to call big deals, that we call big deals now. And it was great. Like the library, we loved the big deals. We were like, wow, this is amazing. We can get thousands and thousands of titles and we don't have to spend all this time selecting each title. But the reality is, as time went by, and every year we were paying 6% more, 3% more, 5% more, it became untenable. And then the packages were fluff. Like, you know, it was like cable packages. It was like you only wanted six channels, but you got 400, but you only cared about six, but you're paying for 400. So I think that they're, you know, John, I agree with everything that you're saying. We really have a big problem, and I think we have enough smart people in the academy to figure it out. The challenge is how do we collectively act to be able to address this situation we have. I saw a hand come up. I thought I did. Are there any other questions or comments from anyone? I put the provocative statements back up.
Can I ask a question, Elaine?
Sure.
I know you just mentioned that there's limitations on what researchers can achieve in this space, but your provocative statement number two suggests that there are ways that we can contribute to positive change. So I'm sure that a lot of us would be really eager to hear if you have sort of like best practices, principles, ideas, ways forward, that kind of thing that can really engage us in that process.
Yes, I definitely have a slide about that, and I will get to that. And the thing is, it's just so complicated, but I will try to give some ideas that I hope will be helpful to some of you. But I'll just pause there before I show that slide. Adam, is there any other questions or comments about any of this? Or if anybody disagrees with some of these statements, I'd love to hear your disagreement.
How can I?
Tara, go ahead.
Sure. I guess I am a little leery of on the one side you put that university presses aren't the problem, and I would push back a little bit. I mean, at least the professional societies that I know, they are not the problem. They are also nonprofits. They are the ones in mathematics anyhow are nonprofits publishing at very reasonable rates. And so, and the, you know, from what I'm aware of the math library budget, they are not the thing that are causing the problem. It may vary, you know, I think again, maybe that's just an example of how much variation there is by discipline. But I think that any solution here is going to have to seriously involve, individual departments and individual faculty to make sure that every discipline is supported as best it can be while we go through some kind of disruptive change.
Tara, I agree with you 100%. I think the societies, the best research is coming out of the societies, no question. And I do worry that they're under all these pressures that are incentivizing them to make really tough decisions. And it's all over the place. I mean, there's some societies that are massive. Like, what is it, the Geological Survey or Society, that's huge. I mean, tens of thousands of people. And then some societies are really small and really struggle to support a publishing program. So, and to support their conferences and things like that. So I agree with you 100%. I don't think the societies are the problem. My one point is that if they're getting pressure to generate revenue through publishing, that's the problem. And how the societies choose to respond to that and find ways to remain viable, that is the question that I think that we have to have some conversations about. And many of you are leaders in your societies. You might even be on the journal committee or publishing committee. And my request would be that when your contract is up with, whether it's with Anna Wiley or whoever you're working with to publish your journal, that you really step back and look at the economics of that journal and what are your goals? And, you know, how could you consider open access as an option? Like, what are some of the things that you could do that are not going to diminish the society and your mission? And I think that's a really complicated problem, because I've consulted with a couple of association societies about this very issue of what do you do, how do you keep your mission alive, and where does the publishing arm of it come into play, and who are good actors, who are bad actors, things like that. Like, I've had those conversations, and it's not, you know, it's not something you're going to get done in a couple of days. This is a really lengthy process to go into.
Ardith Gillespie has been trying to get our attention. Ardith, you want to go ahead?
Sure. Yeah, I'm sorry. I couldn't figure out how to officially hold up my hand. Well, I was just wanted to say two things. As a retired Cornell faculty, I'm delighted with your 10 points. There are things that have been bothering me for concerns for me for many years. And secondly, I also wonder if you're familiar with the Journal of Agriculture, Food Systems, and Community Development. It's a free, open access, open source journal.
Which I am.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I mean, there's evidence that there are many quality journals that are open for everyone to read. And so I think we often get confused, because a lot of the bad journals, the journals that are not peer-reviewed and use fraud and all kinds of things, are also open access.
Yeah.
And so sometimes the good open access journals get tainted by the bad open access journals.
That's a good point, yeah.
But I think the bigger issue is publishing is not free. Somebody has to pay for it. And what worries me is that what I see now is the big multinational for-profit journals are now generating their revenue from open access. And we call it article processing charges. And so there are many cases where I am buying the subscription for the campus, and you as the author are paying a fee to make that article open.
Yeah,
so we're paying twice, right? So that is a problem that we call double dipping that I think I definitely would like to get some resolution. But I think from what I understand, the trend is that more publishers are going to charge you article processing charges. That is clearly the trend that we see, that there is growth, the charges are going to go up, and we're going to see more of that. And I would imagine that given the climate that we live in today, there you don't have the resources to pay for those article processing charges. And for a publication like Cell, I'm sure that's probably about $10,000 of the article processing charge. For PLOS, that's a good $6,000 right there. So these are things that, although PLOS is a nonprofit organization, I love PLOS. But my whole point is article processing charges are growing, and that is going to hit all of you.
Yeah. Yeah. Number five is going to comes into play there. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I'll pause there. I think there are other questions and comments.
There are indeed. John?
Are there obstacles to Cornell and other universities making a list of journals that they recognize as academic journals in terms of the way in which we evaluate our faculty?
So if I understand your question,
so there are a lot of junk journals out there. We should have a list, and faculty should be able to look at that list and say, this is not a place that I'm willing to submit an article, because Cornell is not going to give me any scholarly credit for publishing in that journal. You say there are too many journals. The only way to reduce the number of journals is to restrict your recognition of the journals.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I actually hadn't thought about that. I think the scale of that can be daunting in many ways, but I would say the norms within a lot of the departments seems to be that this is just assumption that people know what the good journals are, right? And in some fields, particularly some of the professionals like business, and they will list exactly what titles, like what journals you need to publish in to get tenure and promotion, right? So there's a lot of disciplinary differences that I've seen, but I think your point is well taken that I don't think higher ed benefits from just creating more journals. I don't think so. I think what we're seeing is the quality and integrity of the scholarly record go down because there's so much. You can't read it all. You can't keep up with it all. You can't peer review it all. I can't buy it all. So why go through this process, and why can't we say as a scholar, you talk about the research you have that has the most impact. Doesn't mean it's published in the most prestigious journal. It doesn't mean it has the highest impact factor or the H index or whatever. You basically say, this is the article that has had the most impact. And this article I've learned the most. Like these are kinds, this is a very different kind of thing of looking at than, okay, here's the journal, here's the impact factor, here's the H index, here's all these things. So, but John, I think you're raising some good points. What other questions or comments?
Lars is next, yeah.
Yeah, I'm an economist, and I've looked at this because I've both run a niche microjournal with good editors, but not much else. And it just went from fully open access, which for the 8 years that I ran it meant that it went begging for funds from various chairs because there was no robust program, to now charging $500 as a processing fee because that's what covers just barely the costs of actually doing it. We're not paying referees, but we are now paying an editor, and there are costs to doing this, even on the cheap, on software that is used by every other mud-raking journal also as well, because we're using OJS for that. I work as a data editor for the largest economic association. I know what the budget looks like. It's public because it's a nonprofit. The publishing business is loss-making, and yet it still costs $200 to submit and $500 to publish to just barely cover those costs and not make those losses larger. But at the same time, if I look at the 10 top journals by impact factor, whatever you want to think of that, only two of those are owned by the commercial publishers. Everything else is in the same ballpark that we're talking about. It's in the social sciences, not in the natural sciences. The processes are different. But for instance, my job as data editor, where we check every single article for transparency of the materials, we rerun the code, et cetera, is paid out of those fees as well. So the scientific integrity is pretty high, I think, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
How does one get to that equilibrium in other disciplines depends to a large extent on the societies. So I think that point is right. But it does not lead to free access. None of those journals are open access. They're all society-driven journals. But access at $25 a year to become a student member is not an impediment to accessing these things. Even professional economists out there in the wild can offer that. At the highest ranking, it's $150 a year if you're a professor or something like that. So open access is not necessarily the solution. But friction needs to be lower than it is, and where in that space libraries sit, to sort of point it back at you, I don't have a good answer to, but there are models out there that have emerged. Why they've coalesced around this rather than the other thing, there's a list of journals you have to submit to. They're all, the fallacy of the top five is well known in economics as well. That doesn't help. People still freak out, but none of those top five are owned by a commercial publisher. So at least you only have to pay $500 to publish, not $10,000. That's, you know, there's that.
Lawrence, thank you for bringing up some really good points. I mean, I agree with you 100%. I think you're absolutely right. Publishing costs and open access journals are not free. And but I do applaud you to have this journal, sounds like a very high quality journal, and to keep the publishing cost down to $500. To me, that's a win. I really do. I think that's a win. To me, I think the heart of the problem is how we fund knowledge creation in general, I think the library is part of that equation. I think the university press is part of it. And I don't think we're approaching the funding of all the knowledge creation in the correct way. So what I mean by that is I'm paying for subscriptions. You all are paying APCs. I have the press whose job is publishing journals and publishing monographs. We are all part of the same organization, yet we're funded in different kinds of ways. And so what's beautiful about the library is I know that we could license far more content at scale than any of you could do at the department level. There's no question about it. I can buy it for everybody, and that's just cheaper than everyone doing it independently. But as the funding gets contracts, I find myself unable to support the causes that are really important. So, for example, if a journal came to me and said, hey, Elaine, we want to be open. If you just gave us $200 a year, that would be enough for us to stay open, and we can keep our costs low, and blah, blah, blah. I'm at the point now where I can't even do that anymore. And I know what the consequences are to that. And so library budgets are so crunched right now that I think it is really such a tough decision to say, you know, we're not going to be able to support open access infrastructure. We're not going to be able to support those things. So I guess all of this is to say is I wish the university could talk about different ways of funding all of these enterprises, because it's all coming. We're all paying, and it doesn't make sense. And I'm not saying this just to say, oh, the library needs more money, but I'm trying to count all your APCs in addition to what I'm spending, and it just doesn't seem right. It is, I'm spending millions of dollars. Collectively, this university is spending upwards, you know, up to $1 million in APCs, and that is part of the whole cost out there that we have to take into consideration.
Thanks.
I thought I saw another hand. Okay, if there are no others, I will just keep going through. So I did my disclaimer. So this goes to what Adam had asked, and this is actually a condensed list. This first one might seem like a head scratcher, but I actually think this is important. I think one of the reasons why the publishers have us over a barrel is because they own everything. And so if many of you could keep your copyright to your article, I think that would actually be helpful, because you control it and you could post it on your webpage. You can do these things legally, and you're not beholden to the publisher. And so what I typically see is when you get an article accepted, the publisher will typically send you a very restrictive contract. And you know, you're tired, you finally get your article accepted, you just want to sign it and move on. But the reality is you do have the option to not sign it and to give them a different kind of contract, or tell them, look, I need to keep the copyright. This contract is not sufficient. And I could share, it's called an author's addendum, and that's a way for you to retain your copyright, or you could work directly with the journal. Now, this is not going to work 100% of the time, and there are a few cases where you might not want to retain copyright, but I think this is a good start for people to understand your rights, and that keeping copyright, I think, is really important. Number two, I already alluded to this, is you all are a member of these societies and associations. The more you know about the publishing arm and the economics of it, that's just really helpful. And I think that talking to them about their decisions and what that means, and because I did have a case where someone was working with their society and they had planned to sell it to a journal, and I basically said, okay, if you sell it to the journal, this is the range that I could pay for it. And what they found out was that the journal cost was going to go up about 40%, which is out of my range. And when I told them that, they were just like, you know what, maybe we need to go back to the drawing board, because, now, of course, Cornell is one institution, But if Cornell can't afford it, then there's several other institutions that can't afford it. Number three is another thing that I think is important is how APCs are designed is a mystery to me. And I don't know if any of you've ever asked the publisher, okay, this is a 3,000 APC. Why is it this price? For the most part, publishers get to make up whatever numbers they want, and there's no transparency on how they get to the number. In addition, why a journal costs a certain amount, I have no idea. What I do know is when I buy a journal, I pay a price. Yale pays a price. Duke pays a price. Carolina pays a price. We never pay the same price for journals. And they attribute that to the size of our student body, our research enterprise, and our historical spend. So what we spend today is based on what we spent 30 years ago. The other thing is flipping journals. This is something that's possible. It's not easy and it's not free, but I have seen editorial boards and basically the leaving mass start their own journal and they work with a nonprofit. It's possible. It takes time, months and months to do it, but we could definitely help help you ask the right questions if you're interested in this. The other thing is number five, intricacies of open access publishing. There's a lot going on. Some of the things that Lars mentioned that I think would be really helpful for people to understand. So preprints are considered green open access. We have hybrid journals where some of it's open access, some of it's not. So there's a lot of things that I could do a two-hour presentation just on open access. And then number six, I mentioned this already, is impact factors and the dependence on them as a symbol of quality is something we should think about. DORA, D-O-R-A, is a organization that was designed to reimagine assessment of research so that we don't depend on impact factors. And then I also, the final one I have is about the norms in your department discipline. Why are we doing it this way? Are these, like, why are we picking these journals? You know, all of these kinds of questions I think are really important because the discipline shapes this problem or part of the problem of what is prestigious and what is not. But promotion and tenure happens at the department level, right? So you got the disciplines doing their thing and setting their norms up, and then you have the department. And I think that sometimes those norms don't always align properly, or sometimes they align perfectly well and give the publishers an advantage because prestige is what people are looking for the most. All right, I think that there's a question.
There is. John McKenzie.
I can't hear you, John.
Your sound's not working.
All right. If you get your sound
if you working. Want to put it in the chat, I can read it out, John.
Hey, Elaine, this is Pete Laux. Did you, you're not hearing me, are you?
Yeah, I can hear you, Pete.
Yeah, you're good. Do you have anything to say about open access books?
Yeah, I mean, I love open access books. And Cornell University Press, which is under my portfolio, so I've been working with the press for the past 4 years. And right now, we're in a situation where in order to publish open access, we need a certain amount of subvention. And so we were able to get a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to help create open access monographs. The cost of a monograph is pretty standard. We know it's roughly somewhere between $15,000 and $20,000 to publish a monograph. So it's really important that we find a way to recoup those resources. Now, every university press is different. I know University of Michigan is pretty much an open access first publishing house. We're not in that same category, but I do see that growing. I think the biggest challenge that university presses have is that there are so many profit and loss drivers that make them wary of doing open access publishing, right? Because no, if they don't get a margin, they don't have their mission. So I know that when I talk to Jane Bunker, the director of the press, she would love to publish more open access books. On the flip side, a lot of researchers don't feel great about open access books, right? They tend to think that they might be a lower quality, even though it's the same process as all of the closed books. So I think there are some cultural norms that have to be overcome for people to understand that open access book is peer-reviewed, it's quality just like another book, but some people feel a little leery about doing that. All right, John McKenzie, can we hear you now?
Test, can you hear me now?
Perfect.
Thank you.
I make a lot of media, so I have long input sometimes. I work over in the English department, but I've been studying media all my life, and I've been studying the basically the rise of the advanced research in the Cold War period, and what's happening right now is of interest to me. So I have a question that really gets to things about the culture of departments. There's something like 28,000 titles, journal titles in the world. That's a lot of titles. And over the last 25, 30 years, it's gone from illiterate to digital. Organizations have gone from primarily hierarchical to much more of a network thing. However, the culture has been one of specialization, and that has stayed the same. When I came to Cornell about 8 years ago, I read about what happened when we became a research one. There was great concern that it would destroy the culture of Cornell because it was not yet a research university. And so there were people who objected to it, believe it or not, thought we would die because publisher pairs would kill us. Some people would say, it's coming back. And so my question is, how do we change culture since we have been so specialized? And I'll just give you a frame real quick. There's people, I study international comparative stuff, a move from missile gap, which drove the Cold War, to God gap. And a move from statecraft to soulcraft. And what that means, that last piece is shaping whole. And so this comes, the right is making this argument. This is what's coming out. So Peter Thiel talking about the Antichrist, that shows that there's something happening there at a cultural level. And as a humanist, I'm very interested. And I frankly don't know how we would change the specialized culture of advanced research, because what we think knowledge is comes from Aristotle, and it is getting more and more specialized. So we would have to go back almost to the Greeks, at least in my mind. And I'm just wondering if other people are thinking about that, and what could we even turn and become holistic again? I frankly don't think we can.
Well, I appreciate your comments and the research that you share with us. I mean, I think that, again, this is hard. We would have figured this out if it weren't so hard. And I guess my biggest point is that people understand the rules right now. And there are some actors that are really out there, like Michael Eisen. He's a researcher at Berkeley. He really tried to disrupt the system. I think the journal's called eLife. And he was actually removed from that editorial board, if I remember correctly, because he suggested that all articles that get submitted should be accepted, right? And then we should go through the peer review process afterwards. And a lot of people were just like, oh my goodness, this is crazy. Howard Hughes is very forward-thinking in the way they think about research, publishing, and how it should be funded. So I really watch what Howard Hughes is doing quite a bit to learn from them. So I think there are some, like I said, Howard Hughes, there are some places that are willing to push the envelope. And I think Michael Eisen is not alone as a researcher who really is committed to figuring this out. And I think the challenge we have is there are some people that think that the addiction is hopeless, that we really just need to burn the system down and start all over from scratch, that tweaking around the edges is not going to be good enough. And I actually tend to agree. I think the little tweaks around the edge are not going to change the system. I think we need to do something much more drastic in order to ease the addiction to journals and question, is the journal and the article the right way to communicate research? are there things that we can incentivize that lead to quality publishing so people actually take risks and publish negative results and do more interesting scholarship? Because right now the publishers in some ways have a lot of influence on what gets published, and people want to publish so that they get tenure, right? So there are these disincentives that I think overtake the incentives to do things a little bit differently.
John, you're muted.
Oh,
John, you're muted.
There you go.
Science and Nature are universally acclaimed as being the most prestigious places to publish in the sciences. Neither one of them will accept anything that has mathematics that's essentially beyond first year calculus. It's worse with science than it is with nature, but their ability to cover all of the sciences in the way that they say they do is abysmal. Moreover, they have a view of what their readership is that excludes mathematicians to a large extent. And I can give you, again, a number of stories of my experiences with those journals. They don't do a good job of editing. They just don't. And that's a problem. So, you know, if the places that every scientist is dying to be published in isn't really doing an equitable, fair job because they think that some disciplines and areas are too technical for their audience, that's a big problem. And it really argues for me that, yes, we should burn the system down and start over again.
Well, John, you're really putting yourself out there to say that science and nature is not doing the quality work. I mean, I can say that in response to that, AI is going to be the biggest disruptor, right? And there are a lot of high-quality journals where AI has been able to creep in, and journals, articles that are being published by AI and that have fraudulent, misinformed images and data sets and things like that, that all of them have gotten fooled. And that's because there's too much. Like, they, article submissions pretty much across the five big publishers are up 20%. And that's because of AI. And that's because there's more global publishing. There's more publishing coming out of Europe and particularly Asia that is increasing those numbers, right? So the reason why that worries me is because that leaves little room for the good actors to be able to write their articles and get them published. There are paper mills where you could go to a website, give them $300, and your article will show up in a journal. That happens right now. And, you know, people do it because it's publish or perish. So, and as soon as a paper mill is shut down, another one comes up. And you shut the same one down out of, you know, somewhere in, let's say, Ukraine. It shows up the next, you know, in Taiwan, and then it shows up somewhere else. So the integrity of the record, I think, is really going to be a challenge for us moving forward in the age of AI. And I know that the publishers are spending a lot of money hiring people to do the integrity work that peer review doesn't do. So now you got to run the data. You got to do a lot more work than you used to have to do because of AI. So that is something else that's really complicating this whole ecosystem. All right. I'm going to share some a few more slides, and as people have some ideas, please share them. One thing is I could say is for the journal that we license, actually I'll give you just a data point right here. 25% of our budget goes to these three companies. If that doesn't convince you that there's a problem, oligopoly, I don't know what would convince you. You know, this is when a small number of people control the market. And you might say, oh, 25% isn't that much, but this is significant. And I could say 15 years ago, this slide didn't look like this. And you see Elsevier's 12%. That's pretty big. And so I already mentioned that we were planning to unbundle Elsevier. And I just wanted to give you a sense. This might not be the exact price of the journal because we don't typically know the prices exactly. But this gives you a sense of some of our most expensive journals. This is a lot to be paying for journals. And it's not always a correlation between the cost of the journal and the quality of the journal and the usage of the journal. It's not always the same. It just isn't. You can't assume because of quality that it's going to be used more. All right, another, actually, I don't have a slide for this, but I wanted to show these are the five publishers I mentioned. And the ones on the bottom left and bottom right, to me, are not problematic. I'm more concerned about Springer, Elsevier, and Wiley. Those are the ones that are challenging to negotiate with. Elsevier is the world's largest publisher. They do a lot of open access, but they are, there's such a monster in this whole, like they're so big that we were in a position where we just couldn't afford to pay that $3 million a year. And we work with the library, Witt Library at Weill Medical. We co-pay for this, and we're going through this process this year, and the license for Science Direct ends in December, but we will continue to subscribe to some of the Elsevier titles, but what's going to change is how quickly you get it. We will get you whatever journal you need from any of these five companies, but you might have to wait 2 hours or 24 hours or 48 hours because we no longer have the ability to license all those titles we used to license. All right. Going back to open access, I do think it's about democratizing knowledge. And I think that being able to have more visibility is really important. And I love it. And so we have what we call our institutional repository e-commons. And say like you have a preprint and you deposit it in e-commons, and we would love for you to do that. You get to see how many times it's actually downloaded. That's really good information, right? And we have ways of finding out how many, like the people, what countries are they coming from that are downloading your work? So that visibility is really important. And I think it's also, as you all know, if it's not electronic, maybe it just doesn't exist, right? And if it's open, if it's not open, it doesn't exist. It's locked behind a paywall. And so it does speed up discovery and scholarship. But number three is one thing we learned during the pandemic is there was a point where the whole world was sharing data about vaccines. And this was really unprecedented. And it is certain that the United States would not have come up with the vaccine as quickly as it did if it did not have access to data being created across the world. So open does incentivize more collaboration and participation because people know what's being produced. And then the final point is it's just more inclusive. Everyone is not affiliated with a university like Cornell. And so I was talking to some one of the scholars on my faculty library board, she works in Latin America, and she was saying, look, there's a lot of places, a lot of people she works with, and they don't have access to a lot of the journals. They don't afford, they can't afford it. And so open access is one of those ways to make sure that her research gets through to her partners in Latin America. This is what I already mentioned, is the learned societies and associations. These are the four things that they do really, really well. And I do worry that our graduate students coming through the ranks, depending on the discipline, are not joining societies at the same rate that they used to. And so if they're not joining and they're not participating in these efforts, they're not paying into them, not just when they're graduate students, but then when they become assistant professors, that to me worries me, because that means they're not bringing in as much revenue, if they're not bringing in as much revenue to support networking, professional development, and conferences, the journals becomes the revenue generator, and that worries me a lot. Impact factors. I already mentioned DORA, and gosh, I'm like blanking on what that stands for, but the key part is there was a group, I think a microbiologist that met over a decade ago, and they lamented on impact factors and how they're not being used responsibly. And so they came up with a, I think they call it manifesto. They can go to this website. You just Google DORA and assessment, and they really wanted to focus on how do we do more responsible research assessment, and how do we make sure that people are reading the article and not just assuming that the impact factor is the quality marker. Preprint servers. So I just wanted to put a couple of them up here. Obviously, we know about Archive, but then there's CAM and REPEC is for Economist. So Lars knows about that. SSRN, which is owned by Elsevier, is a social science research network. There are so many more. Like, I could put like 15 other preprint servers. Preprint servers are awesome. It is one of the best ways to disseminate your research as quickly as possible. I do know that the norms are different across different disciplines. And so in some cases, people can point to a preprint, and that's perfectly fine to be part of a tenure packet. And then some other disciplines is they might submit their paper to a preprint server, get feedback, but they still end up publishing it in one of the legacy journals. So I think in some cases you're doing the preprint and you're also publishing, and in many cases it could end up behind a firewall or it might not necessarily. But preprint servers have been transformative, and I think that, I mean, BioArchive is another one. There's so many different ones. I think they're really helpful. But I do maintain that they are not necessarily designed to disrupt the whole ecosystem of scholarly publishing. But it is a very important service, and it has really made quite a difference in making a lot of research available to the world. This is something I mentioned about taxpayers, and I just wanted to let you know there's this group here, and they're lobbying and trying to find ways for research to be open. And this has also been, I guess, relayed to the federal government and has been some of the reasons why the federal government has issued some policies regarding if you get NIH funding, you must deposit your article and you must make your article publicly available. There are several of those mandates that we have, and I think that they're going to continue. And I think it makes sense. I mean, they, as I mentioned, they are paying for the NEH and NIH and all these other, and they would like to, there are many taxpayers who are lobbying to have access to the research that is created at Cornell and many other institutions. Okay, peer review. I don't know if any of you saw this. This article came out last month about peer review, Breaking, and Fifth in a Chronicle of Higher Education. And I think that this is something that does worry me. Even when I work with the press, getting people to review manuscripts is really hard. And it slows down the process. And it takes a lot of energy to get people to do it, because I think researchers are so overworked. And being able to take the time to sit down and read a manuscript or article, manuscript, something, whether it's 10 pages or 300 pages, is really hard. And I think that in many ways, I don't think peer review's job is to make sure there's no fraudulent research. I think that's the publisher's job. But I think there was a moment where peer review was not such a burden, and that there weren't other burdens placed on researchers, and you had more time and energy to do it well. So here are some of the pros and cons of it. I think for many, of course, this is just part of the price of being a researcher. You contribute to the community. I do know that some of the graduate students I've worked with, I don't know if they feel compelled to engage in peer review. I think that they often see it as uncompensated labor and find that problematic. I know there have been many articles in the Chronicle and other news sites that talk about, well, what if we started paying reviewers? And I know, Lars, you told me about it. Like in econ, you have already decided that paying reviewers for some of your journals makes sense. But for the most part, that is not the norm. In most cases, most researchers are not compensated for their peer review.
And no, we're actually stepping back from that because there is not enough money for that.
Oh, really? Okay. So, and
it used to be paid, but no longer is.
Oh, really? Okay. So there's not enough money. And also, you're not paying them for the full cost of the work.
No.
You're just incentivizing them and giving them a little bit of resources. I do know that there are some journals that are, like, you get a token for peer review, or you get a discount on the APC when you publish. Like, they're trying to bring in these incentives, but at the end of the day, it's still slow. It's slower now than it used to be. You all can read, so I'm going to move on from this. Here are some improvements that I've been reading about that in many ways is, you know, the peer review count, your promotion and tenure. Should we be thinking about compensation? I put this on here, but I really am hesitant because I actually don't think that is going to work necessarily, because it's costly, and I think in many cases it's not enough incentive to get people who are very, very busy to write the review. The research integrity teams, I was at a meeting recently, and one of the editors of a nonprofit open access publisher told me that she has 24 full-time staff dedicated to research integrity. And she said 10 years ago she had one. And I was just like, wow, that tells a lot. Now, number four, I think, is probably my most controversial statement, that peer review, we might want to make it more open and transparent. I know that's controversial, that this idea that you could publish a review and everybody knows who wrote the review and all that, like, that's a challenging one, but I do see some benefit in that process, and I have seen some experiments with working on that, and that's a whole nother thing. Like, that, we could do a whole meeting on peer review and what are the cases when it's open and transparent, and what does that mean? The other part is, number five, is this idea that the job is to reject as many people just seems not right. And maybe the job is to figure out how to get as many people in as possible. I do know that a lot of the high rejection journals, if you can't get into that journal, they have another journal for you. And if you can't get your article in that journal, they have another, right? So they cascade these journals, and it makes money. And I just feel like, wow, is this really the way we want to do scholarship and science? Is, you know, you can't get here, we'll give you this one. If you can't get here, you know, that just seems like a big moneymaker for the journals. The other thing is, like, how do we speed it up? How do we get it done? I think I always have time. I'm going to peer review this, and like a month later, I haven't done anything. You know, the editor's blowing up my email saying they need this review. It's just hard. Like, how do you get it done in a timely way? I do think that peer review does have a lot of bias. That's just the bottom line. Like, how do you get the bias out of the process? And that's really difficult to be able to do. And as I already mentioned, there's just too much. There's too much articles, just too many journals, and that leads to too much peer review that you don't have the time to do. So I have wanted to leave my contact information for any of you. If you have any ideas, if you would like to follow up and partner with me, I would love for Cornell University to be the university that can take this problem of academic publishing on. It is not easy. It is not going to happen overnight because it didn't get this way overnight. But if you are interested in working with me, or if you have some ideas, I would love to hear it. This is my passion. I've been researching on this. I'm working on a book right now about this very topic and some of my thoughts. But there's so much to talk about, and I think this is just really a tip of the iceberg. But I wanted to give you my contact information. I also wanted to give you the link to the online journal transition, and this is really about largely about Elsevier. I imagine many of you are impacted by our need to unbundle our Science Direct package, so you could send your feedback directly with that email. Or go to the webpage to find out what's going on. We're going to continue working now until the end of the year to get information from you to help us make good decisions about how do we unbundle. We're very much committed to getting you what you need. I think what's the biggest change that you're going to have to deal with is convenience. Because we're not able to license as many journals, you're going to have to wait. And I realize when the grant's due Monday and you're working on Saturday, you might not have that time to wait. And we understand that. However, we're really in a, we're in a pickle. And spending $3 million a year just seems crazy. And we're not able to do it. Emory's not able to do it. Columbia's not able to do it. Carolina's not able to do it. I think Princeton. So it's not just us that are saying enough. We can no longer license all these titles anymore. So I really appreciate your patience with us, but we'd love to hear from you, get your input about whether it's the Science Direct unbundling or anything I've talked about, your ideas about peer reviews, societies, how we, you know, some of the ideas that John shared about, you know, surely a couple universities can get together and figure this out. You know, let's get to work. Let's roll up our sleeves and figure out what that future could look like and what could Cornell do that could bring other institutions along. And so I'm here for that. So I'll just pause now and see if there are any other questions. Is it still five, Adam, or are we finished now?
We were finished about 15 minutes ago, Elaine, but no one wanted to stop because this is just too important. Too vital to the life of the faculty and to the research and scholarship that we all do. So thank you. I want to thank you so much for the work you're doing on this, the time that you put into it, your provocations that are extremely useful for getting us all focused on both the unsustainable present and the possible future. I really appreciate your hard work on this, Elaine.
Thank you. I'm so sorry. I misunderstood the amount of time I had. So.
Not at all. Not at all. We were all delighted to hang with you. I want to thank everybody who came. Faculty, thank you all for being here. Please keep your eyes out for announcements of future faculty forums. And I know that there will be upcoming events that I want to flag for all of you around the future of the American University that will be upcoming as well. And of course, we think a lot about academic publishing and its role in the future too. So these are all complexly intricated, interwoven kinds of threads. So thank you all for being here. And Elaine, thank you again for sharing your perspective. Really delightful to have you.
Yeah, thank you for your time. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody.